Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel relies on the generosity of our listeners to advance this vital gospel message about the coming kingdom. Please consider a donation to Beth Emmanuel, where Messianic Judaism is more than an idea. It's really happening.
Blessed be the God and Father of our Master Yeshua the Messiah. According to His great mercy, He has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Yeshua the Messiah from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. 1 Peter 1, 3-5. In these few words, Shimon Peter delivers a whole set of concepts, all of which circle around what he terms a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. What is the salvation ready to be revealed in the last time? That salvation is a major concept in the Bible, also referred to as the Day of the Lord. The Day of the Lord is the future time predicted by the prophets when God directly intervenes in history, reveals His glory, redeems His people, punishes the wicked, and rewards the righteous. That great salvation divides all of history and time into two distinct periods, this current world and the world to come. The event that separates those two ages is called the Day of the Lord. In academic circles, this view of the end times is called the apocalyptic worldview. The Jewish apocalyptic worldview of the coming Day of the Lord that will usher in a new era is the key idea informing the entire New Testament, the kingdom message, the gospel, and the significance of the Messiah. But somehow, many New Testament readers and teachers completely miss it. The problem is that since it was a common Jewish worldview in the days of the apostles, a worldview that most Jews already shared, the New Testament writers rarely take the time to spell it out for us. Every book of the New Testament assumes that the reader is already familiar with the concept. The Apocalypse of John and the Epistles of Peter and Jude are among the most apocalyptic books in the New Testament, but it's entirely fair to say that all of the teaching of Yeshua and the entire New Testament falls in line with this apocalyptic worldview anticipating the imminent Day of the Lord. It's all about the end times, not just the book called the Apocalypse of John. The Jewish apocalyptic worldview is a critical piece of missing information without which the New Testament does not make any sense. It's like the key that unlocks the door. The New Testament does not spell it out because it was so well understood by most Jewish people in the first century. That's because religious Jews in Judea and Galilee of those days lived and breathed the scriptures and also the non-canonical apocalyptic texts like the Book of Enoch. Unfortunately, believers today struggle to make sense of the Bible because we lack this basic information. What was originally common knowledge to the first century Jewish believers is today poorly understood, if understood at all, even by most Bible scholars. To get the broad picture of the Day of the Lord, as it was understood and taught by Jewish people in the days of the apostles, it's necessary to read the Jewish apocalypses that they left behind. But don't worry, I'll give you a quick rundown of the major features and broad outlines of that expectation. The type of first century Jews who wrote and read the New Testament and formed the following around Yeshua of Nazareth believed that in the Day of the Lord, 1. God will pull back the curtain over reality and enter the world in a grand theophany that reveals His existence as described in the Psalms and the prophets. 2. This grand theophany will happen through the agency of the Davidic Messiah King, also called the Son of Man, who is His representative on earth. 3. The Messiah will defeat the enemies of Israel in the war of Gog and Magog. 4. the Messiah will gather the exiles and the lost tribes. 5. God will resurrect the righteous, including the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. 6. The Messiah will rebuild Jerusalem and the Holy Temple. 7. The Messiah will establish the Messianic Kingdom, uniting all Israel under a single monarchy. 8. The Messiah will subjugate the nations and administer the kingdom in justice and righteousness from the holy city, Jerusalem. 9. The Messiah will usher in a utopian era of world peace, universal revelation, and miraculous fertility. 10. The heavenly court will be convened to judge the living and the dead. 11. God will judge the wicked by consigning them to the fire of Gehenna and outer darkness. 12. He will reward the righteous with the delights of the paradisical world to come and New Jerusalem. These 12 points are the broad outlines of first century Jewish apocalyptic expectation of the day of the Lord, although not necessarily in that order. In fact, there is not really one established sequence of these things. Instead, these elements are all like snapshots or short clips and brief scenes of the day of the Lord, thrown together like scenes in a movie trailer spliced together for the coming attractions. These broad Jewish apocalyptic expectations of the future are exactly what Peter means when he speaks of a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. That is to say, ready to be revealed in the day of the Lord. Simon Peter is writing this epistle to encourage his disciples to remain steadfast in a time of persecution. He knew that a period of bitter persecution loomed ahead. I date Peter's epistle to the early 60s, at the height of Nero's reign, when the imperial eye was just beginning to focus on the sect of Yeshua's disciples. Faith in Yeshua was not yet illegal. Disciples were not yet being called before tribunals. The fire of Rome had not yet occurred. Nero had not yet designated the disciples of Yeshua as an illegal superstition charged with the crime of atheism. But these things were about to happen. Everything was about to change for followers of Yeshua. Moreover, the disciples of Yeshua back in Jerusalem were soon to be mourning the death of James the Righteous and several other disciples of the Master by the hand of the Sadducean aristocracy in Jerusalem. The Jewish revolt had not yet broken out, but tensions were already rising. Anger, factionalism, nationalism, and hatred were fomenting like storm clouds on the horizon. These were the last years leading up to a terrible bloodletting of Jewish history that included fratricide, zealotry, terrorism, and, by the end of the decade, the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Everything that Yeshua had warned about. By the time Peter is writing his epistle, his readers are already experiencing persecution from the Gentiles among whom they lived, their former kinsmen prior to their conversion. But let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or as a meddler. Yet, if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. 1 Peter 4:15 through 16. Peter is aware of this, and he knows that things are going to get worse before they get better. His epistle is primarily concerned with preparation for a time of suffering about to break upon the Jewish nation and upon the believers. I might compare it to the turbulent events in Europe in the lead up to World War II. Long before Hitler invaded Poland, German Jews were already under the Nazi boot. Jewish refugees were trying to flee. Persecutions had already begun. But the worst was yet to come. Compare it to the events that are happening in the world today. The stunning reappearance of global anti-Semitism should be a warning to the world that the storm is about to break. Peter's words are no less relevant today than they were 2,000 years ago. by God's power, you are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Yeshua the Messiah. 1 Peter 1, 5-7. Strangely, Peter says that we should rejoice while grieved by various trials, because such trials test our faith. Does that make any rational sense? Who rejoices when grieving? It's oxymoronic, but it's a concept consistent with the teaching of Yeshua, who says, "Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Matthew 5:11-12. This injunction of rejoicing when grieved by trials also appears in the epistle of James. James says that trial and testing cultivates endurance and spiritual perfection. "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." James 1:2-4. That sequence of one virtue leading to another appears also in 2 Peter 1:5-7, and a similar sequence, beginning with rejoicing under testing, appears in Paul's epistle to the Romans. "More than that, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not put us to shame." Romans 5:3-5. In summary, we see three admonitions from the apostles to rejoice under trial and testing. James says, "Count it all joy when you meet trials of various kinds." Paul says, "We rejoice in our sufferings." Peter says, "Rejoice when you have been grieved by various trials." Peter explains what it means to count it all joy. The apostles do not ask us to rejoice in the trials and sufferings themselves, but to rejoice in this: you are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. Discipleship to Yeshua calls on us to endure suffering and persecution for the sake of our faith, our convictions, for the sake of righteousness, and for the sake of the name of our Master Yeshua. Pick up the cross, follow the Master, die to the self. Self-mortification means more than being willing to lay down our lives if necessary. It means that disciples of Yeshua are supposed to conduct ourselves as if we already have died, therefore setting aside the ego and its demands, selfishness, sin, and the desire of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. Peter says that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Yeshua the Messiah. Though perishable like everything else in this world, gold is one of the most valuable and enduring materials that exist. However, even gold is perishable. Unlike the imperishable, undefiled, unfading inheritance reserved for you in heaven. The process of refining gold involves intense heat to remove impurities, resulting in a purer, more valuable metal. King Solomon says that God tests the purity and quality of human hearts the way that an ancient metallurgist tested gold in the fire. Proverbs 17:3 says, "The crucible is for silver, and the furnace is for gold, and the Lord tests hearts." In the analogy, the trials and testings through which a human being must pass are likened to the crucible and the furnace. The one who endures the heat of those trials emerges from them like tested gold. Apocalyptic passages of the Tanakh frequently use the imagery of refining metals to describe God's purification of his people, For instance, Malachi 3, 2, and 3 speaks of God as a refiner and purifier of silver, refining the Levites like gold and silver, so they may offer righteous sacrifices. Similarly, Zechariah 13 says, I will put this third into the fire and refine them as one refines silver and test them as gold is tested. They will call upon my name, and I will answer them. I will say, they are my people, and they will say, the Lord is my God. A programmatic text from the Wisdom of Sirach summarizes the concept of persevering under testing like precious metal in the furnace. If you come to serve the Lord, prepare yourself for testing. Set your heart right and be steadfast. And do not be hasty in times of calamity. Cling to him and do not depart, so that your end may be prosperous. Accept whatever comes upon you, and in times of humiliation, be patient. For gold is tested in the fire, and those who are acceptable in the furnace of adversity, trust in him, and he will help you. Make your ways straight and hope in him. Sirach 2:1-6. Judaism is predicated on the idea that God tests our faith through trials. According to the sages, Abraham endured 10 great tests of his faith, culminating with the 10th and final trial of the sacrifice of his beloved son Isaac. After these things, God tested Abraham. Pirkei Avot says, our father Abraham was tested with 10 trials to reveal the greatness of the devotion of Abraham, and he withstood them all. The tests we endure come in all shapes and forms. As Esther Youngress explains in her book, Life is a Test. Life is a test. You should read her book. All of life's challenges and difficulties are tests, both big and small. Every situation is a test. What makes a test into a test is the choice that has to be made. There is a right answer and a wrong answer on a test. We do not know what things we must go through in life, but we can be certain that all of it is a test. Peter and the apostles had in view the test of persecution for the sake of their convictions about Yeshua of Nazareth. They anticipated suffering as he had suffered and being tested as he had been tested, and they warned their disciples to expect the same. My mind goes to the sufferings the disciples of our Master have endured under godless communist regimes, such as the story of the Wormbrands in Romania, who started the ministry of Voice of the Martyrs, or the story of Brother Yun's sufferings in China. Read Wormbrand, Tortured for Christ, The Complete Story. Read The Heavenly Man. Those are the sorts of tests for which we need to prepare ourselves. But the same principle of endurance and rejoicing in suffering should apply to life's smaller tests, whatever difficulties we must bear up under. The goal is to successfully pass the tests. What's the best strategy for passing a test? Any teacher can tell you that the best way to pass a test is to prepare in advance for it. That's called studying for the test. That's what we are doing every day, every week. That's why we congregate together every week and commit ourselves to the study of the Bible and the Word of God. We are preparing for life's tests. Having fully prepared, we may be confident when the hour of testing does come. When the day of the test comes, you don't need to stress out about it. Our Master says, do not be anxious how you are to speak or what you are to say, for what you are to say will be given to you in that hour. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. As we prepare for life's tests, it's important not to rely upon our own strength. Instead, we rely upon our Father in heaven. Our Master Yeshua taught us to pray in advance of encountering life's tests. Lead us not into testing. Do not let us be overcome by trials, but rescue us from what is evil. The most important thing to successfully pass a test is to know the right answers in advance. So I'm going to give you a great gift today. Yeshua and the apostles have already given us the answer key for life's tests, both big and small. Here's the answer that you need to know to get you through all of the tests and trials you might endure. The Didache says, accept the things that happen to you as being for the good, knowing that nothing happens apart from God. Accept the things that happen to you as being for the good, knowing nothing happens apart from God. Or in the words of Sirach, accept whatever comes upon you, and in times of humiliation, be patient. The secret to passing the tests and emerging from the trial like gold refined by fire is to accept the things that happen as being for the good, and that nothing happens apart from God. If we can get our minds around that, then we will find the strength to endure. Ultimately, that's the secret to surviving the fires of the crucible and the furnace. Never give up on God. Keep going. Keep holding on. Like it says in the Gemara, even if a sharp sword is at your throat, you should not give up praying for mercy. When the 12 spies saw the tests and trials that lay ahead for the children of Israel, 10 of them failed those tests before they even began them. 2 of the spies passed the tests before the trials even began. The 2 that held on to their confidence in God passed the test and received the inheritance. The others did not. Let me give you some examples of answers to the test that will automatically incur a failing grade. I give up. I quit. There's no point. I can never stay on the straight and narrow path. Likewise, certain reactions to interpersonal encounters result in a big red F for fail, namely, breaking the commandment of the master by returning evil for evil, blow with blow, eye for eye. Anytime we turn away from confidence in God, we are failing the test. Simon Peter explains the purpose for life's trials and tests is to prove the genuineness of your faith at the revelation of Yeshua the Messiah. Those who believe in him and stay focused on the salvation ready to be revealed at the last time rejoice in the hope of the coming of the Messiah, the day of the Lord, the advent of the kingdom, the resurrection of the righteous, and a portion in the world to come, even though for a little while they pass through suffering and sorrow. They are able to endure suffering with joy in anticipation of a future joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls. 1 Peter 1:6 through 9. The trick to rejoicing in all circumstances and thereby passing the test is keeping one's eyes firmly on the goal, the salvation of your souls. This is the good news of the gospel message. So we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. As we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. 2 Corinthians 4:16 through 18.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.